From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new CD, Come Dancing, collects the Kinks' hits from 1977 to 86. The Kinks were one of the British bands whose records first caught on during the British invasion of the 60s. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from the group's co-founder, lead singer, and songwriter, Ray Davies. A new 9-CD box set collects the comedy recordings of Richard Pryor. We'll feature a 1995 interview with him. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Book of Shadows, the sequel to The Blair Witch Project. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Vice President Al Gore is campaigning tonight in Pennsylvania, where he appealed to Pittsburgh college students to support him. NPR's Steve Inskeep is covering the Gore campaign.
Gore spoke on the grassy mall of Carnegie Mellon University to a crowd of Democratic activists and curious college students. He warned that the next president will appoint Supreme Court justices who may stay in office for decades, ruling on civil rights cases, abortion, and other issues.
The majority appointed, or the balance of that majority appointed by the next president, will define your rights under the Constitution for 30 to 40 years to come.
Republican George W. Bush is doing well among younger voters, though some surveys do give Gore an edge among voters aged 18 to 25. Today, Gore specifically asked 18 to 25-year-olds to support him. His challenge is that voters that young are considered the least likely to show up on Election Day. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Pittsburgh.
Republican George W. Bush was also in the Midwest today, emphasizing his promise to cut the size of government and return more authority and tax money to the people. Bush sought to portray Gore as a politician who trusts in big government, while the Texas governor said he trusts the people. Bush also tried to counter the effect of a Democratic telephone campaign that's been sending recorded messages to Michigan voters that attack Bush's record in Texas. The phone calls charged that Bush weakened regulation of nursing homes and polluting industries. Michigan Governor John Engler, who accompanied Bush on his campaign trip, characterized the ads as some of the scummiest in politics, while the Gore campaign said they were completely factual. Microsoft says that hackers did not do any damage when they broke into the company's computer system, but the intruders did get a look at sensitive computer code. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Hackers used a computer program known as a worm to get past Microsoft security. The worm arrived via email, much like the love letter virus that crashed so many computers last May. This new program can steal corporate passwords and send them to hackers. Hackers can use this information to get onto the company's computer system. There, intruders saw something they're not supposed to see, the basic source code for Microsoft products that are still under development. The company insists that hackers did not see the code for key products such as the Windows operating system or the current version of Office. It's not clear just how much the hackers did see or what they plan to do with the information. Source code can expose security holes that hackers can use to do more mischief. It can also give an advantage to Microsoft's competitors. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 210 points, or 2.3%, to close at 10,590 in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was more than a billion shares. This is NPR News. Four Palestinians died today in clashes with Israeli troops. The latest violence came after several days of comparative calm, when Palestinians emerged from mosques after midday prayers and began demonstrating in the streets. Some Islamic militants threatened more suicide bombings aimed at Israeli targets. Israeli militants fired on rock-throwing demonstrators in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, leaving four dead and about 150 injured. President Clinton called the resumption of violence heartbreaking. The Food and Drug Administration has proposed banning the use of two antibiotics in animals because the practice appears to cause antibiotic-resistant infections in people. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
The FDA approved animal use of the antibiotics known as fluoroquinolones in 1995. Poultry farmers quickly began using the drugs to control infections that can kill chickens and turkeys. But before long, health officials started seeing an alarming rise in human infections that were resistant to fluoroquinolones. The infections involved an organism called Campylobacter, which often is transmitted through contaminated poultry. Government scientists concluded that use of fluoroquinolones in poultry was one cause of resistant infections in humans. So the FDA wants to withdraw the drug's approval for use in animals, though human use would still be allowed. One drug maker has agreed to take its product off the market. The other plans to contest the FDA's proposal. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
The New York Yankees finished off the Mets last night to claim another World Series title and end New York's Subway Series. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, a Yankee fan, declared it the best baseball series ever and said the city will honor the Yankees with a parade on Monday. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new CD, Come Dancing, collects the later hits of the Kinks from 1977 to 86. They were one of the English bands that crossed the ocean during the British invasion of the 60s and are one of the few that endured through the decades. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Ray Davies, the lead singer and songwriter of the Kinks. The Kinks have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Their early hits included such sexually driven songs as You Really Got Me, All Day and All of the Night, and Tired of Waiting for You, songs that later influenced the new wave bands of the next generation. After those early records, Davies started writing songs that were social satires of the time, like Well-Respected Man and Dedicated Follower of Fashion. I spoke with him in 1995 after the publication of his memoir, X-Ray. We opened with Dedicated Follower of Fashion.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
He thinks he is a flower to be looked at, and when he pulls his frilly nylon and his raked up tight, he feels a dedicated follower of fashion.
I asked Ray Davies to take us back to the early days of the Kinks. The band started performing under the name The Ravens.
It was my brother's band. He was 13 years old. I'd left and gone to college, and I didn't really see Dave. In fact, I didn't live with my brother when we were growing up. I come from a large family, and I explain this in my book, in the sense that I had five sisters, much older, and so much older that... I grew until I was 5 years old. I called my eldest sister mother, so it was very confusing, especially for my mother. But coming from that background, so I didn't really have that the standard brother relationship with Dave, and I left home and went to college and came back, and there was this incredible, this stunning guitarist who knew all these sort of choppy lyrics, lyrical guitar phrases. And he was much better than I was, so I was suddenly reduced to... I wanted to be sort of a jazz guitarist, blues guitarist. I was reduced to being the rhythm guitarist in The Ravens. And Dave was out there in front strutting around and doing his sort of, I don't know, his thing. It was an odd little band, really, because, you know, we were sort of kids, really.
Were you writing songs for it?
Nope. I didn't, we were a covers band. Well, covers, doing things like Smokestack Lightning by and John Lee Hooker songs and Howling Wolf, Smokestack Lightning, and all those sort of laudable, you know, earthy profound blues songs. And it was only later on that we got into Chuck Berry songs. But Chuck Berry was a big influence to me as a lyricist, obviously, later on when I started writing songs. But I had no aspirations to write songs then. I just wanted to play and do well.
Now, how did you start writing then?
I'd written poetry, and I think when we tried to get a record contract, the publishers were giving us songs that were similar to hits of the day, like She Loves You and Beatles songs. And I thought, well, there's no possibility of us actually doing as well as those people, so why not write our own songs? And I started writing seriously, I suppose. I'd only tinkered with it in the past, you know, writing instrumentals. I would write guitar solos to play in the band. As I said, I wanted to be sort of more of an instrumentalist rather than a lyricist. And the lyrics really, when I started writing, it was like an outlet of all these, I guess, young frustrations, you know, normal teenage torment. And I found it very therapeutic. And I've always had insomnia, so I actually found something, and it was slightly before the days of all-night television, so I found something I could do all night.
It rhyme.
Yes, sitting there and with rhyming couplets. Yeah.
Now, tell the story of how the band got the name The Kinks.
Yeah, well, The Kinks were in a pub after rehearsal, and Dave, my brother, and Pete, who was the bass player at the time, wore these capes and leather capes and high boots. And I guess for the early, mid-60s, that was quite outrageous. And Kinky Boots, I think, was a single that it was a program called The Avengers had out. It was a TV show. And this guy standing at the bar, sort of, you know, nonchalantly looking over, half drunk, looking at us and saying, "You blokes who call yourselves The Kinks, because you look like them." I just didn't know quite what to say to this man. And then a man called Larry Page was standing with us, who became one of our managers. He said, "You know, you've got a point there. He's got the point, that guy. You should call yourselves The Kinks." The good thing about The Kinks is that it did leave an impression with people, whether it was good or bad. It was a short, punchy, one-syllable word. And we were on the bottom of a bill with other artists. And our name was the smallest, so it had to be just a few letters. So it seemed to foot the bill or fit the bill in every respect. And it was a name that really people remembered.
So did you have to visually play up the idea of Kinky?
I've always hated the name of Kinks. It's just, I think it's a daft name.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can't think of anything else to call us now except The Kinks. It's just, it's evolved. It's got our own meaning. Yes, it has kinkiness and whatever. But I think those connotations are not quite... I think The Kinks mean, in the true sense, maybe the edges or the wrinkles in society that maybe shouldn't be straightened out. And it's always opposed to walking the straight line always, because life isn't just a straight line.
The first hit that you had was with your song, You Really Got Me. And you write in your book that this was considered too risky to record. What were the problems?
Well, it was it wasn't, I suppose, wholesome enough to be, for the time, something that would be palatable for radio. And now it sounds really innocent, people say, "Well, what's wrong with the lyric?" But for then, you've got to understand, it's a time when people still, although the Beatles were supposed to be a rough and ready outfit and the Rolling Stones were, there was still an element of polish about what everybody did. And the Kinks were a rough and ready outfit, there's no question about it. And so the record company eventually relented and let us record it and to get our character. And that record really epitomises a lot of the way we feel that the fuzzy, raw sound that Dave worked so hard to get is really the way the band sounded. And that's, I think, why it was a success.
Well, it's such a great record. Why don't we hear it? Mm-hmm. And this is The Kinks, You Really Got Me.
So I can't sleep at night. Yeah.
My guest is Ray Davies, and he has a new unauthorized autobiography called X-Ray. Now, what were you thinking about when you wrote the song?
Not a lot, really. It's not a
lot. How did the line come to you?
I'd written a song a few years. As I said, I tried to write instrumental phrases, and I'd been writing those a few years earlier. And there was this repetitive phrase, da 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 da, you know, and going into strange accents and things. And I just probably sat there. We just had dinner at home. I went into the front room of the parlour where we had the piano, the little upright piano, and I started thumping this idea I'd thought of a few years earlier. And the words just came out. I think the subconscious was composing. It was not thought out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the trick. Just the words evolved with the notes, and they match. And looking at the lyric, if I'd brought the lyric to, you know, to somebody and said, write music to that, they'd probably tell me to get out, you know, because it's not very, doesn't look very inspiring. But it's like all these things, when you put the two pieces together, lyric and music, it adds up to something in a strange way.
Now, you said in your book that someone in your management said, well, I don't know whether you're singing to a boy or a girl, so you better put a girl's name in there somewhere.
That's right, yeah. Well, he was concerned about my about what, you know, who I was singing to and what my audience was. And I'm thankful in a sense that he suggested that I personalize it, because although I didn't use a name at the end, I thought girl would be appropriate. And but just thinking about that change probably gave me the, I know it's not pretentious, but maybe it is, a psychological, and maybe my voice, the way I sang it sounded different. I sang the thing like I knew roughly where it was directed. And so although I didn't use Susan or Barbara or whatever, Barbara, you really got me going, I sang girl, and I had an image of somebody there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your book that you managed to keep the R&B feel even though making a pop record.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, that's really true. And also you write that you made a conscious effort to make your voice sound pure and to sing clearly, which I think is really interesting, considering that kind of really like fuzzy, aggressive guitar sound, and you're trying to sing, you know, purely and clearly. It's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, I think it's like the old line, Noel Coward line, you know, remember the lines and speak clearly. We had made You Really Got Me once before, and we'd gone in with the producers and everything, and I'd been on tour, and my voice was a bit croaky, a bit like it is now, and You Really Got Me going. It's like really down there. So I remember that when we came to do the vocal, and we only had 3 hours to do it, so there was I, with 10 minutes to go, and it had to be right. So I thought, I took my voice up a bit, and again, thought I was higher, singing in a higher register than I was. And so emotionally, I was up there in the mid-frequencies, even though my voice was quite gravelly.
Yeah, because your voice got more pure and clear in later records, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. The diction kicked in, the diction factor.
Right, which was never a big thing in rock and roll.
No, but again, our agents, who did come from another era, it was that sort of transition from, I don't know, theatre, I guess. They always said, sing, I know it's blues, but you must be heard.
Well, they sent in someone named Hal Carter. Was that his real name?
Hal, yes. Well, he told me it was his real name.
Okay. So he was sent in to work on your stage act. Mm. Why did they think you needed professional help with your stage act?
Well, we all need professional help from time to time. Maybe we needed it more than other people. As I said, we were a scruffy lot.
Uh-huh.
And musically confused, and I suppose immature. And because our first record had flopped, you know, it was an abysmal flop.
This was not You Got Me. This
it wasn't
You
Really
that.
Got Me. We put out another single, which was a cover. It flopped. It was somebody else's song. They thought, well, this band have got to do something, because they're on the tour now with all these other bands, and they must appear to be better than what they are. And I think they sent Hal along to structure our show a bit.
So what kind of advice did he give you?
He told me how to stand, and my brother, I remember he used to tell Dave to rave on his own in the corner, which I'm not quite sure what he meant by that, but jump up and down, and how to take a bow, all that stuff.
How should you take a bow?
Well, normally I sort of bend down and curtsy. It's...
Did he have you bowing as if you were doing Shakespeare or something?
Is that sort of how to
or singing in a Vegas club?
And we used to listen to him, and then we used to go on stage and do exactly what we wanted to do in the first place. It was wonderful. He did give us some, I'm sure some of it's, it stuck with us, but it was just, I think it was fear that we might not cut it, I suppose. And they were concerned that we were not to, to fail. But you see, the trick is, with the Kinks, was that we could only be the way we were. And when we found that magic combination of the sound that we had, which was, I think, quite original, and the look, the combination worked. And that's why that also helped. You really got me to become a success.
What was the look?
We went to see this wonderful man called Monty Berman. He used to be the costume designer in lots of, well, mediocre British movies in the 50s, I think, and 60s. And by this time, in the mid-60s, he was he had a big industry, you know, just renting out costumes. And he found these red riding jackets. And he combined those with sort of Regency-style frilly shirts, yellow frilly shirts, and strange boots and black trousers. And suddenly we walked on stage and we looked like the Kinks, whatever that is.
My guest is Ray Davies of the Kinks. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
The taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home.
Let's get back to our 1995 interview with Ray Davies, co-founder of The Kinks. The new CD, Come Dancing, collects The Kinks' hits from 1977 to 86. Let's play another song, another one that you wrote. Let's do Tired of Waiting for You, another early hit. Mm. Anything you can say about writing it?
That's from the original bunch I wrote, instrumentals, 2 years before. There is an interesting story because we just had this huge hit with You Really Got Me at number one, and we were doing our first album, and they said, we found a new writer, you know, it was me, and I was supposed to come up with all this material, but I didn't tell anybody, I didn't actually have anything except a few chords, and we went in and did the backtrack to that one morning, and they said, well, put the words, we used to put the vocal down at the same time, and I said, well, I've got a sore throat this morning, can I just do the backtrack first, the instruments first, and then I'll do the vocal later. Because I hadn't written the lyrics, you know, and we did the backtrack, and afterwards I said, well, I really feel I'm coming down with something, a flu or something. So I couldn't sing that day, and I went home and just, you know, went out that night and came in the next morning. I made the words up on the spot, really. And it is another one of those repetitive lyrics, but somehow it works, because even though I didn't think, again, I don't want to keep labouring the point, but I thought that I wasn't writing. I was taking in ideas, and although they weren't going down on notepads or, you know, written, they were inside my head. So it just came out. It's your life and you can do what you want. And basically I was telling myself, you know, I'm on this journey now, I've had this hit record, and it really is up to me what I write. So it was an interesting combination of being a bit of a con artist, telling them I had written something when I hadn't, and letting my emotions, my subconscious take over and do the work for me. It's very easy, really.
So you were fooling them, but you fooled them into thinking that you could do something that you actually found out you could do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, let's hear Tired of Waiting for You, The Kinks from the mid-60s. My guest is Ray Davies.
Sure.
My guest is Ray Davies, and he's written a new autobiography called X-Ray. Well, you were talking before about the guy who was brought in to help you improve the stage act. But at the same time, you say that the Kinks just stirred up an atmosphere of violence.
Yeah.
What was it about them? Was it something that happened on stage or off stage that you think was behind that?
I think inevitably the violence, the music, has a knock-on effect to what goes on off stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also to do with being, you know, very young doing this thing. I suppose we were the first or second generation of new musicians making a career out of rock music in England. And nobody taught us how to do it. And as I said, I was a student a few months earlier, living on a small grant subsidized by the government, you know, to go to college. My brother was at school, and Pete, the bass player, had just an ordinary little job. So we suddenly thrust into the spotlight, you know, on television all the time in the newspapers. And we couldn't go anywhere, you know, because literally it was like lots of screaming girl fans. And I think that if you put people, cage people up like that, I think inevitably they will, something will erupt into violence. And so all that put together ends up with quite a lot of friction.
Well, early on in the band's career, your brother Dave was dragged off the stage by fans and had a big bleeding cut on his head, I think. Did that scare you?
Well, it's what scared me even more. The cut was administered by the drummer.
Oh!
He hit him with a cymbal, which is a cymbal is quite a sharp instrument. But it was, again, from just being living together and this pent-up anger. I think both sides were equally to blame. I didn't actually see what happened, but I looked over and saw the drum kit fall to the ground and Dave on the floor with blood coming out of his skull, whatever. It was quite scary, and I thought the band was over then. They'd never get together again, but they did eventually, and it was still a success.
Ray Davies co-founded the Kinks. We'll hear more of our 1995 interview in the second half of the show. The new CD, Come Dancing, collects the Kinks' recordings from 1977 to 86. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, a 1995 interview with Richard Pryor. A new 9-CD box set collects his comedy recordings. Henry Sheehan reviews the new sequel to The Blair Witch Project. And we continue our conversation with Ray Davies, co-founder of The Kinks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1995 interview with Ray Davies, co-founder, lead singer, and songwriter of The Kinks. The new CD, Come Dancing, is a collection of The Kinks' recordings from 1977 to 86. Now, what was it like for you when the band caught on in the States? Maybe you could tell us about your first American tour.
Our first American tour was an absolute catastrophe because we weren't prepared for it. It was just after my wife had our first child, daughter, Louisa. And I left the country, I think, when she was a week old. So we were living in this tiny bed. A bed city is like an apartment. It's got a bedroom, I suppose, and a little living room on the side. So I felt bad about leaving her. So we went on this tour. I was really emotionally unready. I was unprepared for it. And Dave and Mick had just gone through this incident where, you know, they'd had this fight on stage and David had these 9 stitches in his head and had the cymbal thrown at him. So it was a disaster waiting to happen, really, or a tragedy waiting to happen. And we just didn't get along. It was just a series of really unlucky events. And eventually it culminated in a ban by, again, I don't really know, promoters or the union or whatever. Sometimes it's best to leave it alone. And they did, and we couldn't come back for 4 years.
I mean, when you got back after the American tours, I guess that's about the time that your music changed from, you know, the more rock and roll oriented style to a more almost like social satire.
Yeah.
Songs about people living in the suburbs, songs that commented on, you know, the social mores of the time.
Yeah, well, I realized I was on this, as I said, a journey, this wonderful journey that started with You Really Got Me and Tired of Waiting. And now I could really get and write about people I knew about. And because You Really Got Me was about this frustrated, well, this tormented teenager, you know, who just wanted, I suppose it was a girlfriend for the sake of it, you know, just take a girl out after a dance, you know, go out together in the car, whatever. But now I could write about people I'd known when I was growing up. Songs like Autumn Almanac, which was really was about a man, a little hunchback man who used to live near me, who was a gardener, and he used to walk around the streets, and the kids used to be scared of him, and because, you know, he was an oddity. And I've always, in a sense, been drawn to people like that, odd people who are like, not outcasts from society, but don't walk the straight line again. You know, the kinks of society, I guess.
Well, did you find yourself reading different literature or listening to different music when you started writing different kinds of songs?
What I found at that period, there were lots of people knocking on my door, like, pretending to want to be my friends, who just wanted to know what the trick was.
What do you mean, the trick?
The trick of writing songs that everybody liked.
Oh.
And they got really upset when they couldn't. It's like going to find the formula, you know, of an eccentric scientist somewhere. Once you've got the formula, you get out. But they couldn't find the formula because I think my formula was really simple. I just wrote about these events and people and things I loved.
Well, you must have really confused people, though, because very, very few songwriters at that time were writing about characters. Songs were expected to be kind of autobiographical. Mm. Like Randy Newman has confused a lot of people by writing songs, often about very unlikable characters. So I figure the song that confused the people the most probably was Lola, which is about somebody who picks up someone who he thinks is a woman and turns out to be a man.
Mm.
So did that song confuse a lot of people? And maybe you could tell us the story behind writing it.
Although I don't really touch on it in my book, Lola was a song really about not so much confused identity, but more being protective of my own emotions. I draw on lots of different characters when I write a song. I don't really, and it's very rare I write about one thing. And the fact that Lola was a transvestite is incidental. It was really a love song, and all it says really is that I'm in love with somebody, or that the singer is in love with somebody who may not be everybody's taste or whatever, but he's made that commitment. That's all it's about, really. And the rest is just dressing or cross-dressing.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
So was it based on someone who you knew or an incident that happened?
Oh, no, it was based on an actual incident, that part of it, in Paris. We used to go to this wonderful club called the Castel. It was a bit seedy. It was in Paris. But at the time, everybody went there. The Stones used to go there, and a lot of actresses and a lot of models and people. We used to go down there and dance all night and come out the next morning and go to work and not worry about a thing, and or not notice anything. And one night my manager was there and he was dancing away, and Robert was a lovely guy. He was a stockbroker. Really should have stayed a stockbroker. And he was 6'6", tall and very thin. Typical English, you know, Terry Thomas, a gent. He said, "Oh, Ray, I think I've got onto something here, old boy." I said, "What? See that beautiful girl over there? I'm going to take her out. I think I'd go home with her." And then it was okay until he got into the daylight and realised this girl had lots of stubble on her face, you know, as a guy. But she was really, really attractive to look at until you get in the daylight. So that I used that story, that had occurred some years before I wrote Lola. So I used that and adapted that and put that in as kind of a subplot in the song. But it ended up being the main focal point of the song, really. But as I said, the song is really about a love song. It's a love thing. Maybe a love that people shouldn't know about.
Well, let's hear Lola.
Like cherry cola, C-O-L-A cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola, L-O-L-A Lola, Lola.
That's the Kinks recording Lola. There's a live version on the new Kinks collection, Come Dancing. Our interview with Ray Davies was recorded in 1995. Coming up, an interview with Richard Pryor. This is Fresh Air. A new 9-CD box set collects the comedy recordings that Richard Pryor made for Warner Brothers from 1968 to 92. Richard Pryor started his career by imitating Bill Cosby, but he later said he knew his days of pretending to be as slick and colorless as Cosby were numbered. There was a world of junkies and winos, pool hustlers and prostitutes, friends and family screaming inside his head, trying to be heard. His comedy was filled with his perceptions about being black in America, and he took his personal crises, like his heart attack, and transformed them into comedy.
Anybody here ever had a heart attack? No, motherfucker never admit they had a heart attack, right, Bill?
No, sir, I never did. I had indigestion one time.
I don't care what nobody tell your ass, boy. I was walking in the yard and somebody said, "Don't breathe no more."
I said, "Huh?" I said, "Don't breathe no motherfucking more. You heard me." "Okay, I won't breathe.
And I tried to ease a little air inside of my mouth. And I said, "Say, did I tell you not to breathe?"
You told me not to breathe.
"Well, where are you going? Why are you walking? Stand still."
"Okay, I'll stand still.
Get your ass down."
"Okay, I'm down. Don't hurt me.
"Shut the fuck up. You think about dying now."
Yeah.
"Why didn't you think about that when you was eating that pork, motherfucker?"
Richard Pryor's performing career was ended by multiple sclerosis, which was first diagnosed in 1986. In 1998, when he was given the first Kennedy Center honor for humor, he was unable to rise from his wheelchair for a bow. He could barely say thank you. He had a little more stamina when I spoke with him in 1995. I was in our Philadelphia studio. He was in the NPR studio in Los Angeles. He told me about his physical therapy.
This lady, I think her name is Marie, She's my therapist.
Mm-hmm.
She comes 3 times a week.
What's the therapy like?
Oh, man. Some days, it's like, I don't feel good, you know? And so I don't want to do it. But she says, well, you have to do it. So 3 times a week, that's what I'm put up with.
Was it like moving arms and legs and things like that?
Man, there was a time I couldn't move any of them. I was in bed like that for a while. I couldn't move.
What did you do to pass the time while you were in bed and couldn't move?
Good question. I'm trying to think, what did I do? Oh, I remember I smoked some bass. No, I did.
Did you really? Are you?
No, I'm serious. And my ex-wife, Flynn, came to visit me, and she walked through my stuff, and she found it, and she said, "What is this?" I had a rock, you know. She said, "What's this?" And I didn't tell her, because I was scared. And she said, "Is this dope?" I said, "Nah." I said, "Just looks like it, but that's not really." And she threw it out.
So, have you stopped?
Yes.
Was there a turning point that got you to stop?
Yes. It's called being broke.
Now, let me ask you an odd question. I mean, about freebasing. It's bad for your health, right? But, I mean, your health isn't good anyway. So would it being bad for your health not be likely to inspire you to stop? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You're making sense, is what you're saying. And if I was that type of person that made sense, I wouldn't be where I am. Because I never made no sense. You know, it was like, life to me was like, not supposed to make sense. Because, hey, it's, I don't care how you slice it, you ain't getting out alive. So enjoy as much as you can.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, some of the things you did were really self-destructive. The free bracing, the setting yourself on fire.
That was a definite.
Definitely self-destructive, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you know, and it's the kind of behavior that you're warned is going, you know, to really kill you. And you survived all of that. And now you have a disease, MS, that has absolutely nothing, as far as I know, to deal with, you know, quote, bad behavior. Do you know what I'm saying? So it just seems like such an irony that all the things people warned you would really hurt you.
It was the MS.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with you getting MS.
No, it's just like God said, oh, really? Okay, here, boom. So try that on.
Well, do you think it's God punishing you for things you've done? Is that what you're saying?
No, God don't work like that.
Yeah, so I mean, you could have lived this absolutely exemplary life and still gotten MS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a blessing, though.
Getting MS?
Yeah.
How so?
Because it pushes me forward. I'm going through the therapy, and I'm understanding some things about life I never understood.
Anything you'd care to talk about, or is that too personal to discuss?
There's nothing so personal as when you can't walk the way you want to, and then you have to depend on others to help you. And I go, oh, my God. And that's what it is. It's depending on people. And you have to learn to trust them, which is very hard for me. Very hard. But here I am.
You are so important to so many people. I mean, so many people have, like, looked up to you for so long. Do you feel that you have to try to handle your illness now as like a role model? Do you know what I mean? Like when you're a public person like yourself and people are looking at you, do you feel like, yeah, that you need to do it like a role model? Not that you've been a traditional role model to anybody in the past.
It's like...
not that you've taught us to behave in socially accepted ways in the past.
Yeah. Hey, God gave me this, and I'm going to say this truthfully. God gave me just a little bit of it, you know? He said, so slow down for a minute. Take a break. You know, take a break and look at things differently. So I do. Rich is not a bad person. Look at things differently. So I do. Rich is not a bad person. And this disease is just a disease. And I have it. So that's what I deal with.
I know you keep a gun next to your bed.
Yeah.
What for?
Because the boogeyman might come in some night.
Who are you expecting?
The boogeyman. I mean, come on. There's such terrible things going on in the world. People are crazy. They're serious about whatever craziness it is. And I don't want to be caught in no trap and not be able to get off one shot.
I mean, excuse me for asking this, but would you be able to even use the gun if you had cause to?
No. I think the hard thing I do is having to cock it. Because it's a 9mm. And the bolt is real hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, wait a minute, please. Just a minute.
Right, help me out here.
Yeah, I'll be with you in a minute. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Richard Pryor recorded in 1995. His comedy recordings are collected on a new 9-CD box set. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the sequel to The Blair Witch Project. This is Fresh Air. The Blair Witch Project was a huge success, even though it was made for only $30,000, and it was made by and starred unknowns. Its success was attributed in part to an innovative internet marketing campaign. Now comes the sequel, Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. Henry Sheehan has a review.
Whether it scared you or not, the original Blair Witch Project was an effective spoof of independent filmmaking. Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez, the film's directors, were headed into their late 30s down in Florida without having broken into the mainstream. No doubt the sight of young film school grads turning cheaply made videos into Hollywood contracts galled them no end. It's not a big step from there to imagining Blair Witch's plot, in which a trio of the little monsters are hoisted by their own petards during a poorly thought out and casually shot school project. Dismayingly, Book of Shadows looks a lot like the film the three young filmmakers would have made if they had survived their ordeal in the woods and capitalized on it with a filmmaking deal. All the compromises Hollywood demands are there from the start. A pretty cast instead of a talented one, banal depictions of evil instead of subtle, Okay, not so subtle. Suggestions of it. Titillation instead of chills. Book of Shadows picks up a few months after Blair Witch ends. It goes along with the myth that the movie was found documentary footage, and now the woods outside of Burkittsville, Maryland, where the mysterious disappearances occurred, have become a tourist mecca. We go along with a local tour guide and four curious young people who follow the footsteps of the doomed originals. And in one of those stupefying moves we've come to love from studio executives, documentary maker Joe Berlinger was hired to direct the film. Berlinger's documentaries are fine, and his Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, deals with adolescent dabbling in the occult. But he's apparently wholly unprepared for the demands of feature filmmaking in general, and horror filmmaking in particular. Here, for example, is one of the nearly endless scenes in which he introduces his five main cast members. He doesn't depict them performing characteristic actions, but has them sit down together and introduce themselves and their quaint little beliefs to one another.
Erica, people fear what they don't understand. You gotta realize that.
People think that I drink blood, that I sacrifice children, that I worship the devil just because I'm a Wiccan.
Hey, look, where I come from, people think that because I dress in black that I'm some kind of sick killer or something.
I know, I don't even believe in the devil, okay? That's a Christian concept.
I
believe in nature.
I hate nature.
Like a walking corpse, the movie boasts several fatal wounds, and you've just gotten a taste of one of them. You not only don't care that these people's lives are at stake, you positively relish the anticipation of seeing these obnoxious young narcissists get theirs. But even on that score, the movie disappoints. Some of the cast survives. The most boneheaded move, though, comes courtesy of Berlinger and Dick Beebe, who wrote the screenplay. After an opening sojourn in the woods, the filmmakers transport their characters to a whole other setting, an abandoned factory stocked with technically advanced video gear. The place is owned by Jeff, the young tour guide, who we're told has just gotten out of the loony bin and is only scraping by financially. So it's a bit of a shock to see him in possession of a large brick building and, all told, about $200,000 worth of video equipment. But the real problem with Jeff's digs are their sheer unfamiliarity. The movie has put us in such a strange place that strange actions aren't particularly jarring. The single brilliant stroke of the first movie was to realize that a forest is both familiar and strange, warming by day and chilling by night. Jeff's place looks like a high school gym turned into a Halloween haunted house. The horror film is in appalling shape these days. Thanks to the Scream movies, it's now the province of geeks and smart alecks who, when it comes time to scare people, can't think of anything more frightening than opening a trap door. When was the last time you stared against your will at a movie screen, dying to bolt but determined to stay? Where, oh where, are the beloved ghouls of yesteryear?
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. And Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by singer Jean Lee. She died this week of metastasized colon cancer. She was 61. Her avant-garde vocalese influenced many singers. This is one of her early recordings from 1961, a duet with pianist Rand Blake, on the theme from Laura.
Laura is the face in the misty light, footsteps that you hear down the hall, the light floats on a summer night that you can never quite recall. familiar they see. She gave your very first kiss to you. That was Laura.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Broadway director Hal Prince discusses his life in theater. And Frank Rich tells us how he fell in love with the theater, the subject of his new memoir, Ghost Light. He's a columnist for the New York Times and the former theater critic. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.